Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, thank you for being there. Welcome along to a brand new episode of Writer's Routine, where we're chatting to Paul Carlucci. His new novel is hotly tipped as one of the biggest debuts of the year. It's called The Voyager. We talk about his day job as a copywriter and how learning the rules of writing for that affected his work on a novel. Also, how he took a true story and made it his own. And what moving from short stories to long-form fiction has meant for him.
Now I'm working on novels. I like the larger canvas, the opportunity to have several arcs, and certainly one complete arc. My short stories were often parts of an arc, of a character arc, and leaving the rest implied. Now I'm seeing stories in a more complete way. I'm not in a rush to finish something anymore. I think the way I was as a short story writer, I'm enjoying spending a long time, like several months to a year or more, I guess, with my projects and learning a lot more about the characters.
There is more with Paul Carlucci in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along to the show. My name is Dan Simpson, and this is Writer's Routine, the podcast where we take a look through an author's working day. We see how they get stuff done. We try to borrow, pilfer, perhaps be inspired by other tips, how the most successful do it, people who have got their books out, and we see what we can translate, what we can move to our own work. Now, if you are enjoying the show, 310-odd episodes without looking of advice of some of the best authors around. One of the best ways that you can help us out, that you can help me keep doing this, is just by subscribing, by following us wherever you get your shows from. Maybe you've taken a gamble, maybe you've just found this, someone has recommended it in a writer's retreat, whatever it is. Well, look back in your feed, you've got hundreds of some of the greatest authors around. And by following, this will drop to your feed every single time, pretty much every week. We release a brand new episode, and it really helps all of those rather tedious podcast metric promotion things that everyone in the know bangs on about. So if you could do that, it would be a great help. And if you have a second, drop a review as well, wherever you listen. I'd love to know what you think. This week, yeah, we are joined by Paul Carlucci. Paul has published 3 short story collections, also by day works as a copywriter, making other people's work the best that it can be, and now has published a novel. It's hotly tipped as one of the standouts of the year. It's called The Voyager. It's all about Alex, a motherless stock boy in 19th century Montreal, who was taken in by Serge, or Serge. Montreal is, I think, the French part of Canada, isn't it? Well, plump for Serge, who is a drunken fur trader. They head on an expedition into the forest, which quickly goes awry, and Alex finds himself at the mercy of strange men whose motives are unclear. He thinks his luck changes when he falls into the path of Dr. Beaumont, who seems brilliant and benevolent, but quickly turns out to be anything but. We talk about how Paul's routine has changed through working on different projects and fitting in a day job too. Also, why this novel has been on the back burner for ages until his current publisher saved it and got it onto shelves. You can hear about the switch from short stories to long form, what he's learned along the way, and how learning grammar for copywriting has affected novel writing. And with that, whether he worries that the formalities that he needs to consider for the day job could influence his creativity, how much he dwells on things becoming perhaps noticeable and predictable, I think. So we get through all of that and we run through his very particular blend of plotting and pantsing along the way. And let's start off, as we always do, with Paul Carlucci chatting about what he sees around him in the place where he sits down to write.
Yeah, so we, my partner and I live in a two-bedroom apartment. The second smaller room is an office. We both work from home. So I guess it's primarily my office, as I've been working from home longer. But when I have slow days, she comes in here. There's a little recessed kind of nook in one of the walls where a large desk of around, I guess, four feet of length is pushed in. And so I'm looking at my monitor, my computer, some desktop speakers, some art on the wall, rising over all that, knickknacks on the desk. There's a window to my right, looks out on my neighbor's, the side of my neighbor's home. And around me, there's instruments, and like there's some guitars, a guitar amp, some pedals, there's a bookshelf behind me, some effects pedals, I should say. There's a bookshelf behind me, a keyboard next to that. And the room is maybe 5 feet across or something. 5 feet like wide behind me, and probably 10 or 12 and wider. So yeah, this is where I come to do my stuff. I got my little dog bed for my dog when he comes in here. And it's pretty comfortable.
So it sounds busy. You've got a lot around you, and like an interesting blend of the practical side, but also some inspiration with the art on the wall and the knickknacks on the desk. I don't know, are they like purpose put knickknacks? Is it like stuff to help you write, stuff to help you remember what you're there to do?
Some of it, so the knickknacks are not of that nature. They're like, for example, I'm looking at a mask right now next to one of the speakers that I got in South Africa when I was visiting some friends there. I got it from a curio vendor outside of a park. On top of the speaker, there's like a mini that it's next to. There's a mini globe that my dad gave me for my birthday 1 year. The art on the wall, some of it is drawn by my partner, Jess. Some of it's like, I'm looking at a painting of Ometepe, which is an island in Lake Nicaragua. I'm looking at a Metallica flag. So just stuff that I like, that is nice to look at, or that some, like the flag I've had since I was a teenager. I've just been carrying it around from place to place. The writing related things, other speaker, the one not supporting the globe, I have reference books. I'm a copy editor, so I've got the Chicago Manual style, the APA manual, things I need to refer to correctly style references or whatnot. More related to my fiction, this is next to the mask. I've got a sheaf of notebooks and loose paper, and that'll be stuff that I've taken notes on. Sometimes moving from my bedroom, moving them here to before starting a session, I'll like to refer to those to kind of jog my memory to get me started. And there's post-it notes that can be stuck around as well. The desktop does get a little busy, and there comes a point where I need to clear it and get things organized because it's distracting. But my threshold of that is actually much more allowing than my partner's. When she's working in here, she cleans it quite a bit.
So the busyness, it's very cozy. There's a lot going on. If I were to wipe it all away and maybe put you in quite a clinical environment where there's nothing, would that affect your work rate or your output at all?
Yeah, I would think so, though I'm not sure if it would the effect would stem from the lack of busyness so much as just the different environment. I've never been good at like coffee shops, for example, which is a busy place. Which are busy places, rather. I've just never been good at writing in them. That's too much distraction. Other people, I find it too hard to get absorbed in my work. So I think just the personal nature of the busyness here, like you said, it's cozy. There's a familiarity to it, even if there is a lot of junk around. It's not like alien stuff that will distract me. It's got a certain volume of it I can handle before my attention span starts to drift to it, or a bit of an anxiety almost creeps in because it's too cluttered around me.
I know that you've not got anything kind of pertaining to the story around you, so it's not like there are notebooks or post-it notes or plot points on the wall with a timeline.
They're not on the wall, but this is not related to the Voyager because I'm not working on that anymore, but related to the novel I'm working on now, I've got like some Hilroy pages, or actually it's not Hilroy, but they're legal pad pages I've torn out of a legal pad that I just kind of refer to. Sometimes it's like something I thought of after a writing session that I want to get in next time. It's something I'll have to go back and insert. And other times it's like a bit of a launch pad for how I'm going to get started the next day, like how I want to either continue a scene I've left off, which I kind of do strategically, like leave them a little unfinished to make the starting easy. Or if I've finished something, and I'm not really sure what to do the next day throughout, because I do my writing in the morning, throughout the day, little ribbons of like text will go through my mind when I'm doing something menial, like washing dishes or whatever. And then I'll jot those down on paper. If my phone's not around, if my phone's around, I'll text it to myself. The phone is, I forgot to mention, but it's also on the desk, and I'll refer to those notes or the paper notes or sometimes post-its as well, though I can't really get a lot of text on a post-it. So it's usually more of a notepad type of surface.
And just one last question on the technicality of the whole thing. What are you writing on your computer? And what typeface, what font opinions do you have, Paul?
So I always use, I'm writing on my computer. I've got a little Mac Mini I got a couple of years ago. Before that, I was using laptops. So this little guy kind of unobtrusively sits on the back edge of the desk. The monitor is external. It rises above them. It's probably like, I don't know if that's a foot to 2 feet maybe across. It's pretty big. Helps me see details when I'm doing my day job, errant commas and stuff like that. And a keyboard that is small. I think it's called a Magic. And it's connected to the computer via Bluetooth. And that's the equipment.
What about the font?
Oh, right. Sorry. The font is all pretty much always Times New Roman 12, double spaced. I did go through a period like many years ago where I would switch it just to get myself going. Like there was something kind of stimulating about the novelty of like going from Calibri to Times New Roman or Arial or something like that. I stopped doing that. It just became unnecessary, not something I think about anymore. In fact, I like the formatting on, I use Word, so I like the formatting in Word to actually look the same all pretty much all the time. So I'm not distracted by that and I can get more immersed in the content of what I'm writing.
Interesting there that you said you found it unnecessary, and that points towards someone who is like quite thoughtful about what they're doing and how they're doing it. And I guess that ties in with your other writing job as a copy editor, right? How much you sat there and analyzing like how you're doing it, and is this the best way that you can be doing it?
I mean, I haven't in a while. It's just been working. So while this is my first novel, it's not my first book. I've got a few story collections out. I think the first one was published in 2013. And leading up to that, I'd been getting short stories published here and there for probably 10 years up to that. And I was also a print journalist for a while. So I had for maybe 10 years as well, during the same time as starting to find my legs in fiction. So that reference I made to changing fonts, and then, you know, to get my to just try and jolt my imagination with something novel, that's years ago. And what I meant by becoming unnecessary was just, I just didn't feel anymore. I can't remember exactly when, but I just didn't feel anymore like an urge to do that. In fact, doing it was more distracting. Like trying to find like a on-screen aesthetic for the words was more distracting than just working with what was there. Like what I have set as the default format. And that applies to everything. Like, I don't change my clients, like I'm self-employed, so I don't change my clients' fonts when I get their documents. But I do notice if they've, like, it takes me a little bit to get into Arial, for example, which is commonly used by one of them, if I've had a long writing session using Times New Roman. But changing the fonts would be kind of overstepping. They've chosen what they want. So yeah, I would say the shift came years ago, and the playing around was something I did when I was just younger and looking for stimulation, I guess, to the environment that would kind of like create a little spark of excitement that you could turn into enthusiasm and fuel for focus. When I was writing The Voyager, I wasn't a copy editor. I transitioned between journalism and what I do now, the freelance editing. And I was kind of lost in the economy for a little bit. So I was a construction worker, and that was exhausting work and long days, like, you know, frequently 9, 10, 11 hour days of fairly physical work. So there was no choice but to work in the morning, because you're absolutely, me anyways, is absolutely not going to have any energy when I got home. So I would get up super early, like 4:30, and try and get an hour of that book done every day, an hour and a half, before someone would come to pick me up to go to a job site, or I would have to go catch public transit to do the same. That was pretty helpful of a routine to get into, because I do the same now, even though I work from home and don't have a laborious job like that anymore. I always try to get my writing done in the morning. Try to do at least an hour, two, if I get up early enough, if I've had a nice sleep and can get up early enough to get that in. The type of exhaustion I'll get throughout the day now is a little bit different. Like it's not physical, but I'm staring at a screen for so long, reading so much text, I don't really want to do it anymore at the end of a day. I might go over something I've written in the morning just to kind of smooth out the language, or consider like if I've made some good choices or not in terms of the content, but I won't do any more writing at that stage. I just need to always find, I find I always need to work in the morning when my mind is, you know, least taxed by other responsibilities and more able to focus on my projects.
And then what happens in the afternoon? Are you moving into other work?
Yeah, like I'll do the morning is really like, say something from like maybe, you know, it could be anywhere from 5:30 to 6:30 start, and I'll be done by 9. And at that point, I'll move on to my day job. It can be anything from copy editing, research, proposals and reports, to some substantive editing. I work for one small press here in Canada, or it can be, I do some like one-on-one workshops with aspiring writers I find on job boards, where they make calls to work with an editor. So whatever the work happens to be, I make a switch at around 9. I focus on that. I'll work till 11:30 or something like that. I'll go and do a workout, like a YouTube workout, have some lunch, and I'm back at it by 1:30, working until around 5, and then shutting down for the day. If I have enough energy and I've had a very productive morning with the fiction writing, I might review what I wrote and just, you know, try to copy edit it copy edit it primarily, not to make substantive changes, but just fix awkward writing and rhythm and stuff like that.
It's interesting you mentioned energy. It all comes down to that, really. And especially if you're getting up early and you're writing, especially if you're doing it for 3 or so hours, it's quite a draining activity. How much do you find that that can cause you problems a little later on? Like, how able are you at kind of pushing through and not feeling too taxed?
Quite able. I guess the writing and editing are different. I am using like a different part of my mind, the brain. So I might tap out the reserves in terms of having energy to write, which I find is more energy consuming. There's a creation going on there that is not happening when you're reviewing someone else's text. The creation of like of characters, of their interiors, of settings, their details. This is tiring. Whereas reviewing someone else's work, doing whether it's the same because I'm editing fiction or it's different because I'm editing nonfiction like a research proposal, is less taxing because I just have developed strategies over time, or I have style guides to refer to and I know what the standards are. So I know, there should be a serial comma here, or this is a dangling modifier. I can recognize all that stuff quickly enough after having built skills at it. And it's less tiring, and it's actually kind of a bit of, you almost sort of redevelops or regenerate some energy doing that, because it is a sort of muscle memory.
And because of that job, editing copy for kind of nonfiction, right? I think it is
primarily, yeah.
How much does that get in the way of fiction writing? I mean, you're so used to doing this, and for nonfiction to be a style and you to be, roaming a critical eye over it. How much does that affect how you write fiction at all?
It's affected it wonderfully. So I've been doing this now, out on my own as a freelance editor for, I think, 5 or 6 years. Leading up to that, I had done editing occasionally on the side. Someone would ask me, or an opportunity would come along without me really seeking it out. And in my journalism career as well, like editing community newspapers, but I didn't have certainly didn't have a formal knowledge of grammar, and I didn't have much of a, like an autodidactic one either. I just used kind of intuition. I've always read a lot, so I'd have like a reasonably good sense of, what a grammatically accurate sentence is and what a deliberately inaccurate sentence is, like straying from a standard for a reason. I could kind of sense those things out. But I did have to formalize my knowledge to do this job well, because people will ask you why you've made a certain decision, and if you can't explain like how a complex compound sentence works and what the standard punctuation for one of those is, you just don't have any credibility, and you won't secure an ongoing relationship with the client. So I spent a lot of time formalizing that knowledge. And now I find my writing has really changed for the better. In addition to having over the years developed a skill set in terms of narrative, like how you escalate and how you build a character, how you create a setting, how you build an image pattern, I also have like a sentence level knowledge that I didn't have before doing this job. That's really fun. Like how to create a general context of standard grammar that the reader doesn't have to know formally, but will sort of intuitively understand if they read a lot. And then how to deviate from that to use non-standard grammar, and why and when, and the effect that creates, which I also don't expect most readers will totally understand what's going on in that level, unless they're also copy editors or something, but from it will arise a kind of atmosphere that you can use to create panic, or you can use to create stream of consciousness and so on. And I find it pretty interesting. It's really transformed my approach to writing over the past 4 or 5 years.
Do you ever worry that it becomes too formal, though? That perhaps readers can see that you're doing things because this is the way that you are meant to do them in a separate setting, perhaps?
A little, but I don't actually. There's a lot of the formal stuff that I don't worry about in fiction. A simple example is like a compound sentence. It's two independent clauses, generally punctuated with a comma before the conjunction. So I went to the store and I bought milk. You would say I went to the store, comma, and I bought milk. With those short ones, I seldom do that, even in the sort of standard part of the writing before I've decided to say, take liberties with grammar to convey panic, for example. I don't necessarily worry about that because I don't like the rhythm and it like that it creates sometimes. And sometimes I do put it in there because I do like the rhythm. I'm not worried about whether it's consistent or not across the text, which would be a primary concern if I were a copy editor. I would need to bring the text to standard, and then I would need to be consistent. Whether or not I much like the rhythms or what have you. And the reason is just there's a different expectation of that kind of writing. If it's a research proposal, the reader will want that formality that you describe because it's credibility conferring. And if it's fiction, it might get a little stiff if you do the same thing, and the reader might sense that. So I just kind of freewheel through those things, looking at those areas locally rather than globally across the document. Do I like the rhythm I'm creating here or not? Do the standards help me accomplish a goal, or are they inhibiting me? And that might change every time I reread it. The comma might come in, it might come out, it might come in, it might come out. And if that stuff never got published, I'd probably do that for all time, changing it back and forth. But yeah, I mean, I hope they don't sense a stiffness out of it, but rather like a fluidity. I guess it kind of remains to be seen. I've never had a discussion with a reader on that level, but.
What has it taught you about generally what makes good fiction? I mean, how much has that world of editing taught you about like pace and moments to do one part of the plot, moments to give, moments to hold back? Is there any grand ideas that come from your work editing?
So from the copy editing, not really. The copy editing has helped, like everything I just described, I would categorize primarily as copy editing and say it's helped me with voice. So it almost doesn't really matter what the content is. Those are like aesthetic rhythm based choices that I was describing. What has helped me with the more narrative level stuff is part of my job is, a few times a year, maybe a half a dozen times a year, I have clients who are maybe they're retirees striking out to write their first novel. Maybe they're younger people looking to self-publish or submit, but they're submit to a traditional publisher. But they're new to writing. They do something else for a living, and rather than go and take an MFA, they've gone online to some job boards and posted looking for someone who can help them with a one-off project. Assessing that stuff and assessing it for the elements of fiction, you know, point of view, escalation, detail release, pacing, and so on. Similarly, what helped me go from a place of intuition, which is what I did before doing this job, to something, I wouldn't say formal, but certainly more deliberate and conscious of how the story is moving mechanistically. Just because analyzing other people's work that way as a job requirement really sort of, you know, the effects on my thinking were wider spread and became something I was conscious of in my own writing as I was doing it. So now, like, my revision process is a lot less difficult, and I can anticipate what an editor might say about pacing and extraneous character development or lack of it, and where that stuff should go to achieve at least like the orthodoxy of narrative what would be expected from a generalized approach to story. And if I'm going to be playing around with any of that stuff, subverting it, what am I replacing it with to compensate for taking away that expectation that editors certainly have, but readers do as well, whether they're fully conscious of why or not.
We'll get more into this later with the plot of the novel, but does it help you get it right first time more often? I mean, this is your debut, right? So it's, as in your debut novel, so it's perhaps hard for you to tell. But because you kind of know what needs to be done and what should be picked up on when you are editing it, does it help you do it, get it right first time around?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. So the Voyageur was started, and I think the first draft, it was quite a while ago that I wrote it. So before I had this formal knowledge, so there were pacing issues and stuff that my extremely talented and helpful editor, Mark Richards, helped me understand. And the understanding of them, by the time I got there, I had been doing this job for a few years by the time I got to working with Swift. So I had taken for granted a lot of what was in the manuscript because I hadn't revisited it in a while, but by the time it got signed. But my understanding of his feedback was a lot more immediate than I think it would have been absent that sort of training from editing other people's work. And thinking back to the many short stories I'd written previously where I didn't understand a lot of that stuff and was just sort of pantsing it by intuition, getting editorial feedback that was similar and not wanting to accept it or not understanding exactly where it was coming from. Definitely a change there. My newer projects that I'm working on, I'm almost like second skin aware of these things as I'm going. Someone might, you know, there's a certain subjectivity to this. Someone might ultimately disagree with me about the pacing choices I'm making, but I'm actively making pacing choices, whereas based on this knowledge recently acquired over the past 5 years, rather than just writing, which is what I used to do.
And just dropping back to the work day, is there a goal? Is there an aim for every day? What are you happy with getting done?
Yeah, they're shifting goals. Like, it will depend on where I am in a story. And it can be, I've heard many of your guests from the episodes I've listened to say something similar. It can be like, do I need to complete this scene? Is it feasible for me? Is it a set piece? And if so, is it feasible for me to complete it in a day? Probably not in that case. So I'll need to chunk it. Like, how far do I want to get before I leave off? But sometimes it's not a scene, it's an interior. And how much do I want to get done there? And do I want to complete it? It will depend on whatever insight the character is arriving at in the interior. If it's just a quick reflection on something that's happened, then of course I'll want to complete it and then do some more. If it's something, a deeper, more sort of transformative or transforming insight that the character is arriving at, then I might need to chunk it. Sometimes it's something related to setting, like this is a complex setting I'm coming up with, whatever it might be, and I need to get some specific details to make it pop. Sometimes those details require a bit of research, like, I don't know, if it's a wilderness piece, you know, what trees might be growing in this area, and what do they look like? Like, if I don't have time to go for a walk, I'll look up pictures online. I'll take notes about that stuff on my loose leaf before I even start typing, and then I'll get much less done. Those will be days of maybe 500 words only. But the goal will be to get the specificity down, and if I can do that, then I feel like I've accomplished what I need to do for that session.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We are back with Paul in just a second. Now, if you're enjoying the show and if you'd like to help it carry on, if you'd like to keep hearing some of the best, most wide-ranging, new, upstarting, old, classic, been-there-and-done-there authors as often as we can, one of the best ways for you to help out is by supporting the show on our Patreon page. By pledging to help us out, just a couple of dollars a month, it really helps us keep going. It helps me bring you these episodes more or less every Friday. For that, you get bonus content. There is merch. There is even a way for your book to sponsor this show. We've got book reviews on there, videos where I take you inside my flat. You can see my cat, other things that might rhyme. Anyway, there's so much going on. You can be part of our community, and I'm very thankful if you can help out by doing that. I know that times are tight, so it really doesn't require a lot. The fact that you are there, that you are helping us carry on, that means so much to me. If you would like to make that happen, please do think about becoming a backer over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Let's get back to it with Paul Carlucci, chatting about his highly acclaimed new novel, The Voyager. It follows Alex trying to discover who is worth trusting in 19th century Montreal, lost in the wilderness. You can hear more about that in this part. Also, how about the project would be lost, would be unattainable, unbuyable, if it wasn't for his publisher saving the story. You can hear how he took a true fact and made it his own fiction, and we pick things up talking about his story, his path to publication from short stories to a full-on novel.
Short stories were what I started with because, like, I'm not trained in a formal sense. I haven't gone to like writing school or anything like that, and they were just I've always really wanted to write and love writing. And in my previous career as like a journalist, what I primarily got out of that was opportunities to write rather than like a fierce interest in news gathering, say, or reporting. So I wanted to write fiction because I love fiction. And short stories were just accessible. I don't mean to say that they're lesser because they aren't, but they were accessible in terms of their length. Like, this is something I can do, I can do in a few months rather than, you know, a year or something. So I wrote a lot of short stories. The novel was supposed to be published by my last publisher. They kind of signed it off one chapter at the same time, but ultimately didn't like it, and it was dropped. It was supposed to be published again a couple of years after that. There were sensitivity readers involved in this round. They didn't like it. It was dropped again. And then a couple of years after that, found Mark. So Swift Press and Mark Richards, the editor. So I wasn't working on it throughout all that period. There would just be like bouts of my life where I would go back to it. As I was still primarily writing short stories, I have a collection coming out in Canada in spring 2025 of, I would say, sort of my last batch of interest in the short stories, and culminates in a novella. Now I'm working on novels. I like the a larger canvas, the opportunity to have several arcs and certainly one complete arc. My short stories were often parts of an arc, of a character arc, and leaving the rest implied. Now I'm seeing stories in a more complete way. I'm not in a rush to finish something anymore. I think the way I was as a short story writer, I'm enjoying spending a long time, like several months to a year or more, I guess, with my projects and learning a lot more about the characters as a result of spending so much time with them, a lot more about the settings and the themes as a result of spending so much time with things.
So when the Voyager was not being published, but the idea was in the air that it could be, are you actively kind of chopping it around?
My last collection of stories was called The High Rise of Fort Fierce, and it was a set of linked stories all taking place in this apartment building in northern Canada where I lived for about a year and a half or so. By the time that got signed, I had already come up with the idea for the Voyager from becoming aware of the true story that it's based on, which we can get into later if you like, and had thought this could be something that I can actually make work as a novel. I was writing it as the collection was being, that last collection was being circulated. And when that last collection got interest, I had an agent at the time, and she encouraged me to also show, I guess it was just one chapter of the Voyager to that publisher. And they wanted to sign it as well. Ultimately they didn't like it. So they dropped it. I dropped it around a little bit. My confidence was kind of shook by that. So I would submit it. I didn't have an agent anymore from this point. So I would submit it. I would retract it. I would submit it and kind of feeling a little insecure about it. Eventually it did get another publisher. That was the one that involved the sensitivity readers who didn't like it. And after about a year after signing, that publisher dropped it as a result of that process. Then I stopped. I was pretty shook by that. I didn't submit it anywhere. I don't remember anyway. I think I might have tried a few places in the States, but didn't get any responses. So we didn't submit it anywhere until my partner was reading an article about Kate Clancy and Swift Press and some issues she had with a memoir about teaching and Swift sort of rescuing that book. So my partner was encouraging me to try them. I was not even really writing at this point at all. I was pretty disillusioned with everything. Just editing for work. I just kind of slotted in the back of my mind, didn't do anything about it. Maybe a month later, I was going through an optimistic period, and I did reach out to Mark, and I got with a very brief background, I got an immediate response. He agreed to look at a sample. A few weeks after that, he was keen to see the rest, and maybe a month after that, he wanted to sign it with some. First, we discussed some of those pacing issues I mentioned earlier to make sure I was game to make the changes. And then we just went from there to here.
And just one last question about short story writing. Because you had written so prolifically doing it, how much did it teach you about long-form novel writing? Because I'm just aware that the way that you got to it is so unique to many other debut novelists that perhaps your style would have been completely different to theirs.
Possibly. So initially, nothing. It didn't teach me anything. I had tried other novels and they were messes. I couldn't really conceive of a story on that scale. Like, I could only really, my ideation was just short stories. It was just things that took 4,000, 5,000, maybe 6 at the most words to write, often kind of closer to the 4,000 word mark. But that last collection, the stories were, so that one, The High Rise of Fort Fierce, stories are all linked. And that was like a, a deliberate choice, I believe. I don't fully remember. I think it was a deliberate choice, or maybe it presented itself as a, I wrote a framing story that's quite long that establishes this building and its many generations of landlord. It was built in the Cold War to its demise, destruction some years later, like in more contemporary times. And then I began to think of the tenants inside and how they would sort of interact with each other in real life and if they were real people, and then opportunities to link the stories and arcs kind of arose. And I think this was before I had the Voyager idea, but it was starting kind of to instruct me on how to just connect elements of a larger narrative together. And I think by the time I got around to getting the Voyager idea and starting to work on it, I did feel sort of informed by that experience, and was able to act on that information and you know, rickety at first, but start constructing a larger narrative like that. It's very, very loosely based on a true story involving a fur trader named Alexis St. Martin and a Canadian fur trader and an American doctor named William Beaumont. So in the true story, St. Martin was at a trading post and he was queuing up. There was somebody in front of him buying a gun and, I don't know, loading it or, I don't know, just assessing the purchase. And it went off and he shot St. Martin in the stomach. They called, on Mackinac Island at a small community that was primarily a fur trading post. So there was a doctor on hand. This was Beaumont, who came and was able to save St. Martin, but the wound healed as a gastric fistula. So a fistula is a fusing of two organs, and in this case, it was the skin and the stomach. And so basically we're talking like there's a hole leading from the outside of this guy's body into his stomach. At that time, people didn't really understand how the stomach worked. Like, there were theories. Is it a mechanical crusher? Are there chemicals in there breaking things down? Is food just rotten there? People weren't totally sure. So Beaumont was an ambitious sort, and he saw an opportunity to do some study. So he had Alexei, the real character's name, St. Martin, the real person's name, come and live at his house. St. Martin was destitute, sort of work as a houseboy. And over the course of about 10 years, Beaumont conducted like 200 some experiments on him, dangling foodstuff into this fistula and pulling it out again to observe, you know, whatever it happened to it inside. These experiments culminated in the discovery of hydrochloric acid in the stomach, which had been earlier theorized but not confirmed. And Beaumont is now like the thought of as the father of gastric physiology, and St. Martin also has a place in history as his subject. I heard about this on a podcast while I was walking my dog, and I mean, it's so interesting, and it's kind of gross, and it's very, very weird and strange, and it just caught my imagination. And I just began thinking of a writing project that I could do that did present itself as a novel rather than a short story, just because it's so large. The novel doesn't really have, I initially conceived of it as having quite a bit to do with the doctor and patient relationship, if not only focused on that, but that only makes up about one of its four parts now. I made up their personalities almost from nothing, not quite, but I made up their personalities and their backstories. And there is a book called Open Wound by an American doctor named Jason Karlowash. That's like a high fidelity historical account from Beaumont's perspective, primarily focused on his medical contributions to history. But I was more interested in it from St. Martin's perspective, the role that injury plays in power dynamics and self-conceptualization. issues like that, how we might be, you know, subjugated if we have injury to someone else's ambition, but how there can be a sort of power in that as well. If someone's trying to get something out of you based on that, how can you kind of reverse the tables? And yeah, that was the kernel. And a lot of the other, the book's plot line, the majority of it came to me as I was pantsing. It came to me on the page and then required, but, you know, going back to sort of see the various, changes in both plot and character.
As you said, like, the initial true story there is fascinating enough, fascinating and gruesome. And you're then making a novel out the back of it. It must be quite hard to detach yourself because you need to do your own thing. So how did you start doing that? Like, what did you do? What did you think about? What questions were you asking, even though you were pantsing, before you started typing?
Yeah, I think the main thing was the voice. Like, how was I going to get this aesthetic? So the writing voice and tone in it is quite a bit different from what I normally do. It's you know, it's like a pseudo antiquarian 19th century voice. So sprawling sentences, comma splices, lots of you know, words that have gone out of use, and that type of thing. So developing that voice was the most immediately fascinating aspect of it. And I knew that I did have to do research both on that, you know, specific, event between our series of events between Beaumont and St. Martin, but also the historical context, the colonial place that Canada and places that Canada, and the United States were at, different peoples, Indigenous peoples, where they were at with experiencing those forces, where capitalism and the fur trade was at, and so on. But I didn't want to, I did read a lot of books and online articles, but I didn't want to not be writing while I was doing that. Didn't want to spend like three months of reading or however long it would take. So I was very excited to get going and to use that voice and develop it. So I just did them simultaneously, and you know, as like another form of pantsing, I guess, as I pantsed the plot and the character development, we constantly have to go back and like seed developments in the previous pages so that they had kind of flow to them rather than just random. I also had to go back and seed, historical detail, quotidian stuff about like how you might brush your teeth, but larger things too about where certain Indigenous group had been displaced to and what bureaucratic justifications the governments had, but be they on the American or Canadian side of the border.
And you're talking about the characters there. Obviously changed, obviously different from their real life iterations. How were you doing that? How were you treating them as a clean slate, getting to know these people with some knowledge of who their real life counterparts were?
I think I was primarily going from that set of questions I sort of put forward about the role that injury plays in power dynamics. And I was trying to kind of answer that through characterization for individual characters and then relationship dynamics between two and more characters. And I was letting that govern the personalities that the characters wound up having more so than their true selves, which I honestly didn't read a whole lot about. You can't not learn a bit about them if you study the story, but I didn't worry too much about trying to write like a historically accurate account so much as I was using that as a kernel to explore some of those other questions. And I was mixing in like to kind of help even maybe not as causal as to help free myself from the historical record, but at the same time, I was just mixing in other genre elements I'm interested in, body horror, magic realism, and that kind of also had an influence on feeling okay to part from the historical record and just make up a bunch of stuff, because it was very quickly not really set in the reality that we live in.
And moving on, because of the way that your writing career has happened, with Ryan being a journalist and then writing short stories and now fully embracing long form novels, I guess as you write onwards, as you write more fiction, what have you learned from the process so far that you'll take forward going on?
I'm trying something right now with what I'm working on now, where I'm not doing, and this is the first time I've ever tried this, for my characterization, I'm doing, like, there are no flashbacks. It's not quite filmic in the sense that I do have, like, interior, and I do have, you know, you will see a character make a judgment or reflect on an occurrence, but I'm not doing a lot of flashback or even detailed memory of what's come before. I'm trying to see how the pacing is impacted by just keeping them always in the moment. And that's been a lot of fun. I'm also, at the same time as I'm doing that, I'm trying a different point of view than I normally have, where at the moment it seems omniscient because it's primarily involving two characters, but it's not going to be that way. There's going to be other characters that this couple encounter, and I'm just going to stick, and so it's just going to be limited to those two characters. So it's fun having, normally what I would be doing, the Voyager is all in Alex's point of view, the protagonist, but my short stories have rotated through numerous points of view, but usually do it chapter by chapter. I felt like it would be too hard to do it otherwise. I'm trying that now with this. I'm trying some of the pacing things I've learned. I'm feeling pretty comfortable in how to take what it would have just been a third person limited point of view and just take two of those and put them in a mix together without it quite being round robin. Like, it can't be like one character says something and has a thought, and then the next character responds and has a thought. Like, it's too, like, mechanistic and kind of irritating, like a table tennis pattern you can almost hear out of it. But just getting that in there organically, while at the same time not allowing them to do a lot of reflection on their pasts, but rather having their pasts implied through how they treat each other and the things that they might say, and observing, like, how that influences my pacing as I move from, you know, beginning story to mid and then start with, like, I haven't quite got there yet, but I'm almost there. Start with escalations. This is also the first one that I haven't pantsed. I've actually conceived for the first time of all the major plot movements and the ending, and I wrote them out. And, you know, logistically, it can take some work to get to each one. And
was that conscious, Paul? As in, did you actively?
No, it just it was really weird. It just occurred to me, like, in that form, and I'm not sure if that's a result of having spent a lot of time analyzing plots for work, and now I can conceptualize them that way or what. But it wasn't conscious. It just sort of arose over, like, a day or two. And for the first time, I found myself sitting down with a pad and writing out three pages of point form, like plot movements, going from, you know, getting from the establishing stuff in the beginning story to the escalators in the middle story to the resolutions of the end story. And it's super fun to write. When I do my morning sessions, because I have a good idea of where I'm going, the words come a lot more freely. I'm not, like, my energies aren't distracted by the pantsing reality of, like, where am I going and am I going to have to revise this or junk it? I'm focusing a lot on dialogue and surroundings, setting surroundings and pacing. And it's really fun to be freed up and be able to think about that stuff very solely.
And that is it for this week's Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Paul for coming on the show. The new novel is The Voyager. You can get a copy wherever you get your books from. One of the most highly acclaimed debuts of the year. We'll be back with a brand new author on the show next week. In the meantime, you can support us on patreon.com/writersroutine. If you listen to the show and you're not following, make sure you do subscribe, follow, wherever you get your podcasts from. So then a new episode will drop into your feed every week. And if you have a second, it would mean a lot if you could give us a review too. You can also get into contact with the show using the page, the contact page at writersroutine.com. And we are on X at writerspod there. And I will see you next week with a brand new episode of the show. Until then, thanks for listening. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.